Welcome to South Beach Sessions. I'm Dan Le Batard, and we've been talking on the radio show quite a bit about the Aaron Hernandez documentary on Netflix. Dan Wetzel is an extraordinary reporter. He's really good, and he got close to all of the reporting around the Aaron Hernandez stuff, and so they decided to make a docuseries, a four-part look into everything that happened there, and they did a very thorough job. One of the things that I wanted to talk to Dan Wetzel about is what he thinks is the reason Aaron Hernandez was so flippant about murder. But I also, as someone who appreciates a documentary that lays out for the viewer all the reasons a mystery might have happened without giving you any of the easy answers, I also wanted to talk to Izzy Gutierrez about how being gay might have affected Aaron Hernandez becoming a murderer, because I think it's a difficult leap to make, and I wanted to get Izzy's thoughts on how it is that the film made it. So before we get to Izzy Gutierrez, though, I'd like to start with Dan Wetzel. Again, an extraordinary reporter. I've respected him for a long time. Let's talk to Dan. Dan, what got you into this project?
I started covering this. I mean, I covered Aaron a little bit at Florida and a little more at the Patriots. But he was a football player then. But when he became a suspect in the murder of Odin Lloyd, the evidence when he was finally arrested and the evidence came out, I began covering the case extensively from that point on through, you know, years of back and forth, two lengthy trials, a suicide, just a million twists and turns. And along the way, Kevin Armstrong, who covered Hernandez's saga for the New York Daily News, and I talked about, no matter how much we do on a daily basis, you can't explain this story and all of the tangents and all the characters and all of the issues and everything into it. I don't want to say it's the most interesting or incredible because it sounds positive, but the negative story in every single way, but it's the most fascinating and unlikely story I've ever covered because we just have never seen anything like this. And nobody in the story fits into a clean box that you'd kind of want where you just, there's so many side stories and everything. So along the way, we just looked for ways to kind of tell the story in other manners and teamed up with production company Blackfin and producer and director Gino McDermott out of New York and started working on this. And through a million Hollywood twists and turns, ended up with the Netflix docuseries that just came out.
Which has been very well received because a lot of people are jarred by this, obviously. And a lot of people are asking how, and I didn't feel it got answered very well until recently and what the Boston Globe did with that Spotlight series. What would you say is most responsible? If you had to choose one, obviously there are many reasons, but everything that happened here, because the film made me feel like it was his sexuality was the thing that he was camouflaging.
Well, we didn't want to make a single conclusion because I don't think you can. I think it's a perfect cocktail of stuff to sit there and say it's one thing, his discomfort with his being who he is, or the death of his father, or an abusive childhood, or drug use, or CTE, or being friends with Alexander Bradley, or whatever else you come up with, or never being told no as a star athlete. You know, I really don't think it's any one thing or it would be responsible to say it's that because it could have been any of the others. Maybe you could pull one of those out and this whole equation changes. But we tried to explain Aaron Hernandez, not excuse Aaron Hernandez. He made these choices. He devastated these lives. We tried to pay a lot of attention to the victims and the fallout for what this guy did. But certainly I think the sexuality, because a lot of people didn't know about it, although it's been out there for years and reported in many other places, may have taken, you know, a pretty big jolt to it. But I don't know what the terms of the minutes or would be, but the film tried to present almost every angle we possibly could on what made Aaron Hernandez, you know, unusual or, you know, into this situation.
Do you think that Aaron committed suicide because he was outed on WEEI?
You know, I don't know. So I'll preface on that. My opinion, that suicide, even the people that were talking to him on a daily basis at that point, his attorneys, his family, were stunned that he committed suicide. Absolutely stunned. My opinion is that it was not that he was outed on EEI. I believe he was planning that suicide all along after his second trial, whether he was acquitted as he was, or found not guilty, or found guilty. If you look at the suicide, it took a pretty good amount of planning. It was well staged. There was three suicide notes. It's not easy to kill yourself in prison. He needed to tie his bedspread over and over and over to have the strength to hold a guy this big. He had to soak the floor so his feet wouldn't, you know, he would slip and wouldn't be able to stand up. He had cardboard to jam the door to keep guards out if they found him. There's all sorts of different things. I don't think he pulls that off in 48 hours in a panic. I think he had planned this thing out. That's just my opinion, though. One of the most difficult things with Aaron Hernandez is he left everybody with so many questions on why he lived the way he lived and why he died the way he did. And I think that's part of the interest in his case and the enduring frustration of everybody whoever came in contact with him.
Your reporting shows what as it relates to him trying to get his bonus money back from the Patriots because of the way the law is structured if you commit suicide?
Possible that he knew about this law called abatement that existed for a long time in Massachusetts. And the basic premise is if your case is on appeal and you die during the appeal, you would thus are not able to participate in the appeal. And then you're not found not guilty, but you're no longer guilty. You're just, you know, it doesn't really matter. And I think when they wrote the rule, it didn't seem very meaningful. It's possible he knew about that, and that was one of his goals. He certainly mentioned in one of the suicide notes to his fiance, you're rich. We don't necessarily know that that was it. I also thought it was poorly planned out or poorly thought out. First off, the Patriots, whatever amount of bonus money they may have still owed him, were going to fight paying that extensively. They're not just cutting a check to Aaron Hernandez, even if they did, civil suits against him by the Owen Lloyd family, the Furtado family, the De Abreu family, and others would certainly wipe that money out. So I don't think his daughter and fiance were going to get anything out of it. But what actually happened was there was such an uproar about the idea that Hernandez might be able to game the system that the legislature in Massachusetts overturned the law, rewrote it, and retroactively made it effective so that Aaron Hernandez was then once again became a convicted murderer. So it didn't work. Whether he knew about that or not, again, we just don't know. It's certainly possible. And it's one of the things with, you know, I wish I'd come on here and give you 15 answers, but it'd be disingenuous to do that.
It seemed like Aaron Hernandez liked the structure of prison. That you guys seem to be indicating that.
He certainly did originally. If you watch the film, in the spring of 2013, when he kills Owen Lloyd, he is under enormous pressure at that point. He had been involved, along with his friend Alexander Bradley, in a double homicide in Boston in the summer of 2012, where either Aaron pulled the trigger or Alexander Bradley pulled the trigger, but they drove up on a car, shot up the car, killed two guys, injured another, and took off. Aaron then had that car stashed at his cousin's house in Bristol, Connecticut. He had the murder weapon stashed at the house in Bristol, Connecticut. So even if he wasn't the trigger man, and that's why he was found not guilty, because he just really didn't know which guy pulled the trigger, he certainly was involved. So he had reason to fear getting caught for that. Then the following, he plays an entire season in the NFL. In that offseason, he and Alexander Bradley are down in Florida. Alexander Bradley gets shot in the face. Alexander Bradley says it was Hernandez who shot him. Hernandez says it was another guy. It's kind of Hernandez's theme, is it's always somebody else that did the shooting that I happen to be around. Either way, he has fear of being caught for shooting Alexander Bradley in the face, which would also end his career. Alexander Bradley is a gun and drug kingpin, according to prosecutors. He's a violent guy. He later shot up an entire bar in Hartford, Connecticut, like fired 11 shots in there because of a fight. He is telling Aaron, I am going to kill you. I am going to hunt you down. I have all these guys. We have all these weapons. You're going to die, or you're going to pay me a ton of money. Aaron has reason to fear that coming out and ending his career, but mostly he fears Alexander Bradley killing him. So in those final days of his freedom, he is running around with two bodyguards, guns. He is self-medicating with all sorts of
drugs and basically acting like a guy who thinks he's going to get killed any day and have great fear. So I think when he actually kills Odin Lloyd, which I think was out of that paranoia, we don't know why, but he kills him and gets arrested, there's almost a sense of relief, like, I'm in my cell. At least no one's going to murder me in here. And he adjusted incredibly well to jail life and prison life that stunned corrections officers, because they said, look, you get a guy in there, any guy, let alone someone from the background, you know, not a career criminal, or at least not known, and you put them in a cell and they will crack. They'll get suicidal. They will be screaming, banging the doors, crying, yelling that they don't belong here. Aaron just sort of settled in. And we have those jailhouse calls of him calling his cell cozy and feeling very, very at home. Aaron didn't do that. And I think part of that in that time was just the relief of, I'm not going to get shot and killed today. I think the enormous pressure that he was under, that all from his own doing, mind you, but the enormous pressure he was under in the spring of 2013, jail at that point seemed like a safe haven.
Can you explain to the audience, you mentioned his cousin, Tanya Singleton, can you explain to the audience the lengths of her loyalty and then answer the question as to why she was that loyal?
She was older than Aaron, but not a ton. Maybe a decade older. I'd have to look that up. But she was an older cousin who, when Aaron was 16, his father passed away, and his mother began seeing Tanya Singleton's husband, and he moved into Aaron's house. And it was obviously a traumatic time for anybody when your father passed away and now there's a new guy in the house, and that happens to be your beloved cousin's husband. So there's a lot of trauma inside the family. He starts hanging out with Tanya Singleton at 16. It's a very permissive place to hang out. It's not the place you want any 16-year-old boy, you know, suddenly not having a father to hang out. So they grow very close. When Alexander Bradley and Aaron Hernandez are involved in the double homicide, they take the murder car and the murder weapon and they put it in the garage of Tanya Singleton's house in Bristol, Connecticut. She is willing to house this car for up to basically a year before it gets discovered. When he's involved in the killing of Odin Lloyd about a year later, his two accomplices, Ernest Wallace and Carlos Ortiz, both go directly to her house in Bristol, Connecticut. These murders are all up in Massachusetts, a couple hours away. She ends up driving Ernest Wallace to Atlanta and then buying him a bus ticket to, I think, Miami. Talks at another point to try to get Carlos Ortiz to be able to go to Puerto Rico or somewhere else and get away. She also gives money to both of them. So she was complicit in covering up, accessory after the fact, that type of stuff, on basically three different murders. And she was willing to do that for Aaron. Now, when the police came and said, look, this car we've been looking for in connection with a double murder in Boston is in your garage, your cousin is the prime suspect, what say you? She refused to talk. They hit her with a contempt charge. She was willing to go to jail. She had two young children, two young boys, and had breast cancer. And basically her cancer treatment had discontinued. And they say it had disastrous effects on that. And she essentially dies in part. She gets out of jail later. They let her out, but she passes away. So this is incredible loyalty that Tanya Singleton offered Aaron. And I think that, and I know you've watched it, like the amount this story is about loyalty and disloyalty or betrayal is remarkable, because that there's nothing admirable about that behavior in any way. But I think you can look at it and go, that is a loyalty to behold.
None of them seemed very bright. The cousin seemed like she was his mother, and Aaron's mother seemed completely awful. So it seemed like the only place that Aaron Hernandez got something that to him felt like love was from this woman.
I think that's a fairly reasonable look at it. Like, this is the unconditional love of a mother, although I don't know that a mother should be covering up multiple murders. But, you know, if you think about he's basically forced out of his house when, you know, obviously he could have stayed at the house, but it almost becomes untenable after his dad passes away. It was already a difficult home. He had a terrific older brother, DJ, but he was off at college at that point at the University of Connecticut playing football. And Aaron was kind of cast out into the open. And so, yeah, I think he found a community and the love and support at Tanya Singleton's house, although that house was nowhere where you'd want a 16-year-old hanging out.
Why did Aaron's fiance, Shayana Jenkins, choose Aaron over her own sister? Her sister was dating Odin Lloyd. Odin Lloyd was killed by Aaron Hernandez. Why did she choose Aaron?
Who knows for sure? Like I said, it's loyalty and betrayal. So here's Shayana Jenkins, who exhibits incredible loyalty again to Aaron Hernandez. He has a way of getting people to be, extremely loyal against their best interests to him. And she is willing to not only not turn on Aaron when it's suspicious, the behavior is completely suspicious, or question him, even though it's her own sister's boyfriend that has been murdered. She is suspected by the prosecution of taking the murder weapon out of the Odin Lloyd murder weapon out of their house in a box and throwing it in a dumpster, which she conveniently can't remember what dumpster she sent it to, there was this box. He just texts her and says, there's a box downstairs, go get it, dispose of it. Anyone who's in a relationship, imagine texting your wife or your girlfriend and saying, hey, just go move that box from the basement and go put it in a dumpster somewhere, and she immediately does it, never asks what's in it or where it went. It's not very plausible. She did all of that and stuck with him to the bitter, bitter end. Even after, his mother wasn't showing up at second trial, anything, she was going to stay with him and do that. In turn, in doing that, she betrays her sister, who was up in Boston attending law school and met, was dating Odin Lloyd, who was by all accounts this, really happy-go-lucky guy and someone everyone liked and didn't have an enemy in the world, and is the innocent victim here. She turns her back on that and never goes back to it. Why? I don't know. My guess, again, just my guess, is that she had this sort of dream life going, and I think she just didn't want to believe it wasn't real and that Aaron was what she hoped he would be, or it would continue, or all of that. But whatever it was, she chose Aaron over her sister. And that's a tough one to understand for most people.
For the record, we can dismiss this now, okay? You are someone who is factually reporting this stuff out. So anything I'm asking you to do in the way of opinion, I will ask the audience to understand that you don't want to give your opinions on this, but your expertise is thorough. You have been deeply embedded in this story, and so it's informed by a great deal. And so I ask you, Aaron's mother, when you saw how the docuseries played out and you saw his mother depicted, what was the thing that made you wince about her? Because she seemed pretty terrible.
Well, I think the key to this docuseries is the jailhouse calls, which, as we worked on it, became released publicly from the jail. So you have Aaron now talking freely and candidly to people. And prior to this, you never had Aaron's voice in anything. He never talked. He never testified. You couldn't interview him, anything. So he was a little bit of an unknown quantity. All you had was other people talking about him. And that's similar with Terry Hernandez's mother. As these calls come out, you now hear this is more raw. This is more personal. This is more telling than any interview you could do, because no one would sit down and talk like this in an interview. So you have Aaron and his mother arguing over things, talking about how she was a terrible mother growing up and how you screwed up my life and why did you think I'd be a perfect angel, and her yelling back. There's a point where she complains that he didn't just give her $1 million, which she needed, and he's in jail, and all the different things. I think there were numerous of those conversations that made you wince and almost, I don't know, it's almost uncomfortable hearing such a personal and raw argument between the two. But it certainly, it opened up the whole idea that there was significant, I don't know if trauma is the right word, but significant difficulties between Aaron and his mother that were unresolved and played a serious role in his development or lack of development. So I think they were very, very telling, but I mean, I think the part where she's asking for the $1 million might be the most uncomfortable, but when Aaron is unloading on her about how he could never trust her, how he could never talk to her, and he's basically saying, you don't know me, I'd love to tell you things, and you're going to die not knowing your own son. You know, with everything we know about Aaron Hernandez, it's some pretty amazing stuff to hear.
I know there's no easy answer to this, Dan, but what one reason among all of the reasons that you're trying to use to explain the inexplicable would you say is responsible for why it is that Aaron Hernandez was flippant about killing people? You certainly laid out all of the theories right down to CTE. You laid them all out.
We tried. Yeah, we tried to do everything, you know, as much as you can in 3 hours, and then try to provide some kind of substance behind them, too, not just, oh, we had CTE. Well, this is what CTE is, and this is what it can do, and the backstories on different people and all of that.
Have you heard much criticism of the docuseries? Like, what's the fairest criticism of it? Because it's been very popular.
You know, I don't know. I mean, there hasn't been a much. I mean, it has been very popular. Is it fair to use the phone calls if the people don't know they're going to be in a docuseries? Well, you know, if you're on the jailhouse call, they say we're recording the call. So is it fair to the victims to have this account out there? I certainly can understand that sentiment. That's sort of the news business. I don't really brush off almost any criticism. I usually just kind of, I mean, it doesn't necessarily mean I'm going to act on it or anything.
But it was very thorough. The job you did was very thorough. I don't know that
we
it
tried hard. I guess that's, I feel comfortable because we tried hard. And this wasn't one of these things where, because there's other stories. We didn't come in at the end and just try to sum it all up real quick. Like, we tried to talk to everybody. We spent months covering these trials. You know, Kevin Armstrong spent like 10 days in front of Aaron Hernandez's house at the beginning. I mean, we both covered both trials. And you try to find out as much as you possibly can and tell the story as best as you possibly can. And you give it your best shot. And so usually as long as you try that, I know you've worked on some incredible stories through the years. I mean, I generally feel, don't you think when you've done it and you go, hey, this is what we got. Yeah, could we have done this? Sure, but this is what we did.
I just thought that it was covered very poorly nationally when the story broke. I know it was being covered well in Boston, certainly better in Boston. But as you said, in our lifetime, Dan, there hasn't been a story like this. In our lifetime, there's not ever been something this kind of inexplicable.
No, I mentioned in the docuseries, you know, talk about OJ, and OJ obviously is incredibly influential story and a bigger story than Aaron Hernandez. But the actual crime was the crime was domestic violence. And so you have an older player, a retired player involved in repeated domestic violence and then accused of killing his wife. You know, when a young woman comes up dead, the first suspect is always the husband or the ex-husband. I mean, we've seen domestic violence, so not justifying it, not minimizing it, but we've seen this crime hundreds of times. Ray Lewis, okay, two people end up dead. That's a street fight. One night in Atlanta, there's a big fight. Two guys end up dead. Total tragedy, not minimizing it, but it's like one night. It's a fight that got out of control. We see that all the time, unfortunately. We've never seen a guy in his prime involved in a drive-by shooting where they just shoot up a car and kill two people and injure another months after he catches a touchdown pass in the Super Bowl and 1 month before he signs a $40 million contract with the league's preeminent team, then is involved in another homicide, execution style, right near his house, perhaps because of paranoia that he's going to get murdered. You know, it just, I don't know that the stakes ever were quite properly explained. I think we have a media culture that wants quick and easy answers, black and white, fit in a box, the whole thing. And you just have this spectacularly crazy crime and all the things that go into it. And so I think it's tough to cover. It was a challenge the whole way, and it remains a challenge now, and I'm not sure the story's over. Who knows what comes next?
There was a voice in the docuseries, but not a face, saying that Aaron Hernandez so feared for his life that he asked Belichick to trade him to a safer place, and Belichick said no. Where was that information coming from? Who was saying that?
His agent in a grand jury testimony said they asked Belichick to trade him, I believe that is. That's not my voice that said it, but I believe that was where that's from. But Aaron was telling people there was a drug. I'm going to paraphrase this. I'm not 100%, but I believe it was there's a gang or a drug dealer that he had funded in some way, and this guy was threatening them if he didn't pay him a bunch of money or was being extorted, and he just wanted to get out of New England. And nobody acted on that. He was not taken out of New England. Aaron feared, I believe, he shoots Alexander Bradley in February. Alexander Bradley gets shot in February, allegedly by Aaron Hernandez. Bradley then lives, says, I'm going to kill you or you owe me money. This is the off season. Aaron, Shayana, and their child moved to California for a few months. They have to come back for some mini camps and stuff. But he thinks he's going to be hunted and killed, or he certainly has reason to fear it, because, again, Alexander Bradley can absolutely kill him and would. There's no reason to think this guy's just joking. And he knows once training camp starts in late July that his whereabouts are going to be obvious. Easy to know how to find Aaron Hernandez once training camp starts. He's either driving to, he's going to be there, you can follow him home after. Now you've got all this, you know, he's got the side apartment, all the different things. He's trying to get Ortiz and Wallace to be around him. And so,
how could the Patriots help with the flophouse?
I don't know. Here's the one thing I try to be fair with the Patriots and with the University of Florida or any of these coaches. You hear some of his friends that do care about him. Boy, yeah, I thought things were getting a little out of hand. I thought he was on the edge. But I think you would say this guy's going to get popped for you know, failed drug test or a DUI or a bar fight. I don't know, whatever the normal crimes or police incidents that occur with professional athletes. None of them good, but
not murder. Not flippant about murder.
I don't think it's fair to sit there and go, they thought, oh, you know what, he's probably involved in, you know, executing his fiance's sister's boyfriend. I think that's what he's doing. I think he's literally in a death gunfight with a guy, or you know, he's shooting up cars. I don't think it's fair to be like, you know, people probably just thought, well, he's just being Aaron, just get him an apartment. He probably just wants to get away from his, you know, who knows. But I do think you have to provide, in hindsight, yeah, this is unbelievable. But at the time,
why didn't they know it? Why didn't they know it? I'm playing the result. Why didn't they know that the most inexplicable thing that any of us have ever seen was going to happen?
Yeah, I think you got to be fair. So,
all right.
I'm not looking to clear Bill Belichick or anybody else, but it's like, he probably, you know, what were the chances this was it?
Yeah, fair enough. Dan, you are always fair. Thank you for being so generous with your time.
Thank you, Dan. Real pleasure to be on. Always appreciate you.
Many thanks to Dan Wetzel. You should check out his work. It's thorough and it is fair. We're going to get to Izzy Gutierrez in just a second because there's another avenue here that I'd like to explore. But before we do that, let's bring in Mike Ryan to tell you a little bit about the people who are making South Beach Sessions free so that you can consume it.
Dan, South Beach Sessions is brought to you by ZipRecruiter. Hiring is challenging, but there is one place where you can go where hiring is simple, fast, and smart. And growing businesses connect to qualified candidates. Cafe Altura's COO Dylan Miskiewicz experienced how challenging hiring can be after unsuccessfully searching for a director of coffee for his organic coffee company. But then he switched to ZipRecruiter and saw an immediate difference. And you can too by signing up for free at ZipRecruiter.com/beach. ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. No, it finds them for you. And its technology identifies people with the right experience and invites them to apply to your job so you get qualified candidates faster. In fact, after posting his job to ZipRecruiter, Dylan said he was amazed by how quickly candidates were applying and found his new director of coffee in just a few days. With results like that, it's no wonder 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. See why ZipRecruiter is effective for businesses of all sizes. Try ZipRecruiter for free at our web address, ZipRecruiter.com/beach. That's ZipRecruiter.com/BEACH.
Thank you, Mike. Thank you to the sponsor. Thank you to Dan Wetzel. And before I thank Izzy Gutierrez, I would like to explain to you that I've known Izzy Gutierrez for a really long time. I have known of his struggle with trying to come out and the difficulties that that posed. It's not something you can possibly imagine unless you're experiencing it yourself. So Aaron Hernandez had some difficulties with being gay. We do not know how much his hiding had to do with the persona he became in terms of tough guy, but I wanted to get Izzy's perspective on this, so let's do that now. One of the things that I thought the media did a very poor job of covering during all the speculation and all the reporting around Aaron Hernandez was the idea that he may have been gay. And I just don't think any of us were equipped to sort of thoroughly investigate how or what that had to do with anything happening with Aaron Hernandez. So this documentary makes an attempt to tie those two things together in a way I haven't seen very much of before. And I wanted to talk to Izzy Gutierrez, who is sometimes very alone in a male-dominated industry as a bit of a pioneer, sort of telling the cavemen what the gay experience can be like in sports and how frustrating it is. So I wanted to talk to him about a variety of things near Aaron Hernandez. So I ask you this first. Did you see any connection points, any familiarity as a University of Florida guy, as someone who took an interest in Aaron Hernandez's career? Did you see anywhere where you made some connection points?
I definitely did. I mean, even just starting with his high school teammate, his quarterback, coming out and telling that story about their personal relationship, it gets a little muddied when you consider the supposed or the alleged sexual abuse, right? That he was apparently his brother wrote in his book that he was sexually abused, and that gets muddy because obviously, like, that can definitely affect a child and affect his mental well-being.
But will almost always deeply, deeply scarring and shaping by any scientific study.
Exactly. And so the reason I look at that connection with his high school quarterback and say, oh, like, this isn't something that is made up, this is something that is real, him at least exploring that side of his sexuality, is because A, I've seen that before. You know, my partner Anthony was in high school and he dated girls. You know, he was in lengthy relationships with women, but was attracted to men as well, and had and I'm not betraying any confidences here, something he shares publicly, but had a relationship with another boy in high school, and that person tried to out the two of them after a while. And what he realized, and
that's horrifying.
It's terrible.
That is horrifying.
Absolutely horrifying in high school when you're not prepared, when you're in.
And nobody is of an age to be adult, and it's like you just are scorned person and ashamed. Oh, good God, I can't imagine like the extortion that feels like, where, hey, I've got your dirtiest secret. I've got your greatest shame that you're hiding from family members. I'm going to expose you.
And this is someone who, Anthony, who after that, actually it might have been even before that, was so, and this is what I think people don't understand, is how shameful you feel, how there are voices in your head telling you, you are not as good as everybody else. And the shame that comes with all of that, he had already decided as a teenager to go seek hypnoconversion therapy on his own, without parents, without any sort of direction. And that
just to scrub it away, scrub absolutely this thing away that you don't want anyone to see. You don't even want to see it. You want to scrub it away.
And think about what kind of walls you're building up, right, in that scenario. Me, myself, I never went that far, but I definitely sort of compartmentalized and just shut the sort of personal side away. And I had the good fortune of being successful in other areas. So I would say, well, look, I can just stack my successes over here and say I'm doing all of the right things, and I don't need this part of my life. But what you don't realize is that it all sort of completes you. And so you're not a complete person there, and you're not really in touch with your emotions at all. And I think, so you go back to Aaron here, and you see a guy who they painted a picture of him being, you know, in a Hispanic household that was very, you know, if you were gay, it could be the worst thing in the world.
Well, I don't know that they're a lot worse in terms of Hispanic homophobia's passed down. Hatred passed down, like, that's a tough one to navigate. I don't even know which one's worse, growing up gay around football or growing up gay around Hispanics, where you find much of these things, or bisexual, much of these things are a source of just generational passed down homophobia that is really strident.
It is. And it doesn't hurt any more than it does when you hear it from, you know, your own loved ones. And so you could imagine that there's this, you know, you look at Aaron's successes, right? They were in sports. And so that's the proving ground. That is, regardless of what your sexuality is, you can't question me if I'm tough on that football field, more so than any other sport on that football field. And so, again, this is all, you know, presumption and assumptions here, but you could see, and I could see, him just leaning into football so much and say, look, not only am I really good at this, watch me take these hits, watch how tough I am, and watch how I sort of slough them off and continue to be this successful person. And again, he did it in high school, did it in college. You start getting that feeling of, you know, getting away with what he knew that was, again, be his proving ground. That would be the area where he could say, look, there's nothing else wrong with me. Look how tough I am. And whether he's taking those hits to the head more so than others, whether he's taking them harder, whether he's just, you know, ignoring them more.
It was a bad case of CTE. For those who haven't seen the documentary, it was a bad case of CTE. Do you make any leaps from there to, was he punishing himself? Was he punishing himself because in some way he felt like he deserved to be hit for his shame, his secret?
Yes. I can see that, and the further he went professionally, the more he saw, you know, that whole thought process and that whole way of being, and that being in the NFL, this is what you are, and it's because you're tough. And again, it's proving it over and over and over again. And there is a lot of self-hatred. I just wonder if he actually was able to really even acknowledge the self-hatred, whether he could
ever look at it. It didn't seem like he was looking at it very much. Those jailhouse interviews, it didn't seem like he was looking in a lot of places where it's hard to look, where you have to go to the deepest parts of introspection.
And a lot of the times, and I'll go back to Anthony, for example, so you shut basically strong emotions down. You take those, eliminate those from your life, and then later you can't really function the same way. Like Anthony, for example, can't really cry. Like, he literally wonders if, you know, if people die in his own family, will he, you know, get
so
that
repressed
emotion?
That's how repressed. Like, it's you get so used to shoving stuff down that you stop having basic human emotion.
And think about when, if at all, Aaron would even have to face those thoughts. Why should he? Who's questioning him while he's alive? I mean, at least before he got in prison. Is this, you know, his teammate in high school trying to out? Didn't seem like it, right? So why would he ever really need to face that? Why would he ever want to be introspective? And perhaps that's what happened in prison. Perhaps that's why he ended up having this, you know, this pen pal, this partner.
Jailhouse lover,
if you will. And there was some sort of release there, maybe some sort of introspection. And who knows, maybe that led to part of his decision to end his life and to keep those who loved him from having to face this on top of everything else. Think about comparing those things, right? Being a murderer with being gay, and that he probably considered one worse than the other, given everything that he went through. Now, I have a lot of people, or I have read.
That's a fairly amazing thing you just said, and it's probably true that he probably thought it was worse to be gay than to be a murderer, because he was awfully flippant about murder.
Because you could explain away whatever it was, the anger that these other people created in you. You can't explain what it feels like to have been born in a way that it is just unfair to you. You know, a good friend of mine, Wade Davis, used to play in the NFL, and he says, you know, one of the best phrases he said to me was, there's no value in being gay. There's nothing that you can take away, at least, you know, publicly currently. There's nothing you can take away and say, haha, my life is better because of this, because I'm gay, unless, you know, you want to talk about, like, not having as many kids and maybe having dual incomes or whatever. But outside of that, there's nothing valuable there, and there's nothing but shame that comes with it, especially in your early life. When you don't, you know, when you're around football and you're around people using this language, and it's just like, well, obvious. And so it runs so deep that I just don't think people really understand it. And it's constantly in your face. You can't avoid it unless you come out and say, hey, I'm gay. Don't talk that way. Who's going to do that? You know? And so not many. And so there's definitely, I definitely believe that is, if this is all true, that is something that he measured and that he absolutely felt could have been worse.
One of the things the documentary was trying to do is present to everybody here, look, here are all the things. It may be all of these things. It may be one of these things more than the other. We don't know. It's all here in front of you. How flimsy or thorough did you find the link to being gay as part of the storytelling in this documentary?
I didn't think it was flimsy. I just think it wasn't sort of brought together with it all, because there's elements of all of it, I'm sure, obviously.
It's complicated. I don't know how many people you're going to get on the record talking about this.
No. And I think, you know, when, speaking of which, when his high school quarterback is on the record, is openly talking about this with his father beside him, that is not some sort of a money grab, an attention grab. That is a very vulnerable position to be in. He's not gaining much of anything there, is he? I mean, would you?
No, I was surprised that they both did it. I was curious. I wanted to know more about their story, because I was wondering to myself, is that father doing that because of however hard he made it for his son, that he's trying to make amends? He's trying to find some healing out in front of everybody. I'm going to show you guys that how wrong I was. I'm going to sit here next to my son as he talks about being gay to everybody about a murder. Like, I just thought it was fairly extraordinary that they wanted any part of any interview.
I would say for the father, it was very self-soothing, probably, say, like you just said, but I would even say for the son, for the, you know, his former teammate, I think it's more of, and this is the reason that I am as open as I am and talk about it as I am, is just like, don't let this happen to you. You know, don't hide something that, I mean,
learn from me.
Talked about them realizing after the fact that they were actually in a relationship. Like, Aaron probably realized after the fact that they were actually in a relationship, and it scared him to death. And so for him to be out there and saying all these things, I believe that person 100%, whether, you know, he liked Aaron more than the, you know, people are trying to say, oh, he had a crush on Aaron. So that's absolutely ridiculous. What do you gain from saying this about a person who has passed? Like, it doesn't make any sense to me. So therefore, you know, that's where I start making all those connections. And I didn't know that going in, know the details about his relationship with his quarterback, and so many similarities just started, you know, flying at me during that documentary. And I think. People don't, and I can't hammer this home enough, people just don't understand it's mental abuse that you take when you're growing up around that, and it's confusion, it's thorough confusion.
During very difficult years, to have formative years that you are having something that feels like mental abuse.
Yes, and you don't realize it until after the fact, and fixing it requires years and years of just, you know, basically the reverse. And my situation, I still have a ton of confidence issues. I still have, I still have like body issues. I have all kinds.
You have more body issues than I do, and it doesn't make any sense.
It really doesn't. And so, but it all comes. I have anger issues that, you know, competitively when I compete, and I didn't realize this until like a couple of years ago, when I compete physically, you know, the anger comes out at me if I'm not as good as somebody, and it says, and I say to myself, why would I be angry about that? This person is 12 years younger than me, way more athletic than me, and I don't train in this sport. Why am I so angry? And it's because, man, if I can't prove to you this right here that I can do this, then that makes me less than, that makes me weak. And it's just like, I know a lot of guys might think that way, but I mean, the anger that really, that comes out of me a lot of times, and people used to call me, you've seen it in me, Dan. You've seen me play basketball.
Yeah, I was stunned by that. I had not seen that side of you before it presented itself playing basketball, where you got really, I've never seen you angry in any other environment.
Right. And even like Anthony, when he was in high school and a lacrosse player and very good at it, used to love going across the middle and just getting whacked over the head, because it was, again, it was improving. Like, these guys can't even hurt me. They're throwing a stick and hitting me in the head, and look at me, I'm still scoring. That, and he didn't realize what that meant, why he felt that way, until now, when he's still very much proving himself constantly, and just doesn't recognize it at times. And I can absolutely see that in a guy who had the world, had everything he'd ever wanted, and was still acting out, lashing out angrily in a way that nobody understood.
Mike, this has been very serious subject matter, and I need some help with the fun part of this South Beach session, which has to be making fun of the father of the quarterback, just his general way of being. Nothing about the subject matter, but just the father. And I know I'm putting you in a bad spot
here.
You
want to make fun of the father?
The father.
From that documentary? I don't know if I can do it.
The father was a bit of a gas bag. The father was very look at me. I don't know how to explain the father. The father
being so look at me made me really uncomfortable that they were going to him on such a touchy issue, because I understand his proximity to things, but I really wasn't at all interested in hearing what
I wanted to hear from the son. I didn't want to hear so much from the father.
It was quite the contrast where you had the look at me guy and you had his son just looking scared to death right next to him and didn't, I mean, I would imagine he had to sort of pause several times and sort of retake and stuff because he looked like he was sweating. He looked uncomfortable.
Well, but how, I mean, why it must have been. Yes. I mean, of course he's uncomfortable, but his dad didn't seem that uncomfortable. His dad didn't seem any kind of comfortable, uncomfortable. His dad was like, he sits down for the interview. All right, boys, we're ready to make me a star.
I can do that thing again if you need it. I don't think I quite nailed it the first time.
Our thanks to Izzy Gutierrez and to Dan Wetzel. It was and is a very interesting documentary. You should check it out on Netflix. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Another thing that you should check out while we have you is Mystery Crate, Dan.
So
Izzy Gutierrez is often a part of Mystery Crate. By the way, this is our contractually obliged promotional spot for Mystery Crate. I know we root for each other's success, but it's a little weird that I'm talking to you every week. But, man, last week's episode, in advance of the big game, we had all the guests that you want to hear from. We had Patrick Mahomes on that pod. We had Jimmy Garoppolo. We had Andy Reid. We had a very uncomfortable moment with Fred Warner.
This is really weird being in the South Beach sessions. Is it always this, like, you know, serious?
It was so serious. You guys creeping around in here is making me uncomfortable.
By the way,
I don't like you near the vulnerable stuff.
By the way, I've seen Izzy's anger on the golf course, too.
Yeah, man. Sorry.
Thank you for
that.
Sharing, though. I know it was vulnerable. I also have my own specific trauma stemming from watching you be angry on the golf course.
You throw one club.